All right. Kind of an interesting slide to start off with here. This week in life groups, we're going to continue our study on the Sermon on the Mount, and we're kind of closing out 3 weeks now of reflecting on the question, who is our audience? Who is our audience? If I consider my life a performance, so to speak, that will be evaluated, who is my audience? Who is the spectator? If my life and my deeds are, say, a work of art, then who is the art critic that's going to stand back and evaluate that work? And so this week, as I was preparing the life group lesson, I got to thinking about that question, and it reminded me of something that was in the news a few years ago. And I don't know if any of you remember this. A few of you, maybe? I want to read this story here from the New York Times, just parts of this. It says, two California teenagers who recently visited the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art were less than impressed by some of the exhibits and wondered if they could do better. And thus, a scheme was hatched. I like these guys. They placed a pair of eyeglasses on the floor, stood back, and watched as, within minutes, visitors regarded their prank as a work of art, with some even taking photos of the fake installation. The teenagers, I'm not going to try their last names, they're kind of weird, but Kevin and TJ, they were 16 and 17, both of San Jose, had been left scratching their heads at the simplicity of some of the museum's exhibits, including two stuffed animals on a blanket. Is this really what you call art? Kevin said in an interview over the weekend. TJ added, we looked at it and we were like, this is pretty easy. We could make this ourselves. Kevin placed his Burberry glasses on the floor beneath a placard describing the theme of the gallery. He said neither he nor TJ did anything to influence museum visitors, such as standing around and looking at the glasses. Within 3 minutes, people appeared to be viewing their handiwork as bona fide fine art, though Kevin said that without his glasses, he could not see what was happening too well. News sites like the Huffington Post and NBC Bay Area reported the episode after TJ posted photos on Twitter, helping to propel a lively debate about what counts as art. A San Francisco Museum of Art representative was unavailable for comment. I bet. Does it? Yeah. John, that looks like really great art. Now, here's a question. If God was the only one in that museum that day, reviewing the exhibits, would the pranksters even have attempted such a stunt? Would have been pointless, right? If we are doing our deeds to be noticed by men, we know that we can trick them. It's really not even that hard to trick people. I've been tricked, so have you. It doesn't take that much to impress us. We know that it doesn't really need to be good art if we are the art critics, we are the spectators. But what if we are conscious, you and I, as we live our lives, as we display our art, what if we are conscious of the one who can read our motives, who can see into our hearts? I think that should be the goal. We're going to meet one such person this morning from our text in the Gospel of John. She did not do her art to impress men. She did it for God. But first, let's do a little review. Last week, we studied the account of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead. And this was not only a demonstration of his power over death, it was a foreshadowing of his own resurrection by which he would permanently defeat death on our behalf. And that is why Jesus could declare to Martha and to us, "I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me will live even though he dies, and whoever lives and believes in me will never die." And he asked Martha, and he asks each one of us, "Do you believe this?" That's the question. Remember, this was a public miracle. There were lots of people there to see it, lots of Jews from Jerusalem, because Bethany was real close to Jerusalem. And we're going to pick up now where we left off, and we're going to overlap a little bit. John chapter 11, starting with verse 45, if you would turn there. It'll also be on the screen behind me. It says, "Therefore, many of the Jews who had come to visit Mary and had seen what Jesus did put their faith in him. But some of them went to the Pharisees and told them what Jesus had done. Then the chief priests and the Pharisees called a meeting of the Sanhedrin." Okay, to do what? To earnestly study the matter? To vote, maybe, on whether to invite Jesus to the next meeting of the Sanhedrin so he could share the story and give his account? Were they meeting to patiently and sincerely work through the question, who is this Nazarene? Is he the Messiah or not? Is that why they were meeting? What was their purpose? We'll see as verse 47 continues. "What are we accomplishing?" they asked. "Here is a man performing many miraculous signs. If we let him go on like this, everyone will believe in him, and then the Romans will come and take away our place and our nation." So no, the meeting of the Sanhedrin had nothing to do with discovering the truth. It had everything to do with protecting their own interests. Their minds were already made up. They weren't even considering a change in course. In 1529, October, the most important Protestant theologians in Europe were called together by Philip I. And they were gathered together to the Marburg Castle to discuss with one another their differences on the doctrine of Christ's bodily presence, and hopefully to iron out all their differences and not come out of that castle until they had reached agreement. Among those present were two especially prominent Protestant reformers, Luther and Zwingli, and they found themselves on opposite sides of this debate. Would they come to agreement, or would they stay in that castle forever? Well, the whole thing was doomed from the start. Luther admitted in his opening statements, "2 years ago, I rejected this idea. I had made up my mind that I would abide by my opinion until the end of my life." There is no stubbornness like religious stubbornness. Because we manage to convince ourselves that God himself is on our side. And if he isn't, he should be. Don't be like that. Of course, Luther couldn't hold a candle to the Sanhedrin here. Doesn't matter what Jesus says. Doesn't matter what he does. We're not even going to dispute this, that Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. We've made up our minds about him. And we are going to abide by our opinion until he dies. It's noteworthy that this group of religious leaders, having acknowledged Jesus' miracles, didn't try to say, "They're fake. He's tricking people. He's using magic." They didn't even try that. Not what they said. They had one thing on their minds, namely this: what they stood to lose if Jesus became more popular. In the Old Testament, we see that the office of the high priest was a lifetime appointment. It's kind of like the Supreme Court, right? And at this point in Israel's history, however, it was a temporary appointment because it was a political position. And the Romans actually appointed the Jewish high priest. And there was nothing that Israel could do about that to stop them. It was just a Roman thing. And they went along with it. I think it was a one-year term, but it could be, you know, somebody could be removed from that position if they weren't towing the line. And while it might look like, you know, somebody could look at this and say, well, that's kind of noble, though, that, right? They're trying to protect their people, protect their temple. It says our place, protect the land, our nation, they said. It's really the word our that should probably get our attention here. I think it reveals what they were really protecting. If everyone came to believe in this Nazarene miracle worker, it would have likely, at least in their judgment, spurred an uprising, which would have gotten the attention of the Roman authorities, who would then renege on the freedoms that they had extended Israel, and the ruling party of the Sanhedrin would likely be dissolved. They would lose their power, and that's almost certainly the driving concern here, and I think we'll see that even more clearly. Verse 49. Then one of them, named Caiaphas, who was high priest that year, spoke up. You know nothing at all. You do not realize that it is better for you. Better for whom? He's talking to the Sanhedrin. Better for you that one man die for the people than that the whole nation perish. He did not say this on his own, but as high priest that year, he prophesied that Jesus would die for the Jewish nation. And not only for that nation, but also for the scattered children of God, and bring them together and make them one. This kind of reminded me of Saul, King Saul. Do you remember when he was prophesying and people were shocked by that? And they asked, is Saul also among the prophets? What's going on here? Yeah, he is. For a period of time, anyway. God made him one. Same with Caiaphas. Don't mistake Caiaphas for a good man. He's a bad man with a good word. God can use anyone. And the prophecy was a solid one, right? It was as good as if Isaiah himself had delivered it. Jesus would, in fact, die a substitutionary death. Caiaphas prophesied that he would die for the nation, just not in the way that he was expecting. Let's talk about these evil men, the ruling Sanhedrin, and we'll see more of them, obviously. But we naturally wonder, I think a lot of us, how do they get to this point? What would make these men so evil, so wicked? And some believe that God made them that way. Some believe that God hardened them, okay? He hardened their hearts. And that's why they were that way. You know, I don't find any reason to believe that. They were already hardened. God used them in that hardened state. Do you know that God doesn't have to harden people? People harden themselves. They do. I hope you never do that, but you can do that. You can harden your heart. It's possible. That's why the book of Hebrews warns repeatedly. Today, if you hear his voice, don't harden your heart. And God might use a self-hardened man. God might use a group of self-hardened men to accomplish his divine purposes. And the scriptures teach that he might even, in response to their self-hardening, harden them even more for his purposes. And so from that day on, they plotted to take his life, it says, verse 53. And that was all in accordance with God's plan. But there was also some timing involved in this. And that's why verse 54 says Jesus no longer moved about publicly among the Jews. Instead, he withdrew to a region near the desert, to a village called Ephraim, where he stayed with his disciples. Now, kids, I got a question for the kids. Why do you think Jesus moved away from Bethany, Jerusalem, out toward the desert to Ephraim? Why do you think he moved there? Was he scared? Was Jesus a coward? What do you think? Hope he's going, no, that doesn't sound like Jesus, does it? Why did he do it? Was he hiding from them? No, he wasn't hiding. Jesus was waiting. Jesus was laying low for a purpose. There was timing involved here. All right? And it was just for a time. And then verse 55, we see that the time arrives. It says, when it was almost time for the Jewish Passover, many went up from the country to Jerusalem for their ceremonial cleansing before the Passover. They kept looking for Jesus. And as they stood in the temple area, they asked one another, what do you think? Isn't he coming to the feast at all? Now, here is why I think they're asking that question. Jesus was a faithful Jew. His parents had taken him to Jerusalem for the feast. So he was in this practice. They were used to seeing him. Okay. Verse 57, but the chief priests and Pharisees had given orders that if anyone found out where Jesus was, he should report it so that they might arrest him. You think Jesus knew about that plan? I think he knew about it. Chapter 12, verse 1. 6 days before the Passover, Jesus arrived at Bethany where Lazarus lived, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. Here a dinner was given in Jesus' honor. So this was a celebration. This was a, maybe we should say a happy occasion. But there was definitely something ominous looming. If no one else understands it, Jesus at least is aware of the plans that were unfolding at that very hour. It says, Martha served while Lazarus was among those reclining at the table with him. And this is typical of what we know of Martha, right? You guys know the story. Probably you're familiar with that from Luke 10, that story of Martha was going around making all the preparations and Mary was just sitting at Jesus' feet, right? And some of you think of your own holiday celebrations. You've got the people that everything has to be just right. You have the other people a little more laid back and they just want to visit and they maybe put a little more emphasis on the relationships and we're all built a little different. Well, this is Martha, right? Martha's serving. And it's almost a repeat scenario here, except for this time Mary wasn't just listening. She was up to something. Mary had a plan. What was she up to? Verse 3 says that she took a pint of pure nard, an expensive perfume. She poured it on Jesus' feet and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume. I have a relative who uses about a pint of cologne every time he comes out of the shower. And not really, but you might think so if you walked into the same room with him. Or even if you walked into the room an hour after he left. A pint. That is a lot of perfume, right? That's like, you know, a bottle of water that you carry around, 16 ounces. That's a lot of perfume. And not just any perfume, but the best. Nard was from India. It was extracted from the root of the nard plant. I've never seen a nard, but it was very expensive. And just how expensive, we'll soon see. Now, why does John tell us that the house was filled with the fragrance of perfume? It seems like we could have figured that out if we thought about it long enough. Isn't that kind of an unusual thing to record? I don't know if there's anywhere else that John records scents or, you know, the odors that were in the air. This is a vivid image that I think John wants us to appreciate, so that we can kind of sense how wonderful the scene was here. The loveliness of the scent matched the loveliness of the scene itself. There are beautiful sights, there are beautiful sounds, beautiful deeds, beautiful smells, and here all of them converge. And we should know that. But I wonder if there's maybe even something more to it. Why John drew our attention to this, the fragrance in the air. In the Old Testament, we find dozens of references to an aroma pleasing to the Lord. You can do a search on that. An aroma pleasing to the Lord. And when we encounter that expression, it's never referring to like a field of flowers or some pine forest. What's it referring to? It's always a sacrifice. It's always an offering. And I wonder if there's a connection here. In the parallel accounts, Matthew 26 and Mark 14, I believe it is, it says that this nard, this perfume, was poured on Jesus' head. What's it say here again? Where was it poured on Jesus? Okay. So, now I can't believe my Bible anymore, right? Because in Matthew and Mark, it says on his head. Here it says on his feet. We've got a contradiction. I guess, boy, put the Bible away. The critics are right, right? Contradiction. How much perfume are we talking about here? A whole pint? You think there'd be enough to do the head and the feet? And if you had a 16-ounce big bottle of sunscreen, do you think you could probably cover your whole body with that? Like maybe all summer long? I don't see a contradiction here. I see one author focusing on one thing. And to anoint the head would have been what they'd do with a king. And maybe that was Matthew's focus, because Matthew tells us all about the kingdom of heaven. And here, it's the feet. Not a contradiction, not a problem. In fact, in those other accounts, it says, Jesus says that she's preparing my body for burial. Okay? Now, not everyone was impressed with Mary's extravagant sacrifice. To some, that beautiful fragrance was a bitter stench. Verse 4, one of his disciples, Judas Iscariot, who was later to betray him, objected. Why wasn't this perfume sold and the money given to the poor? It was worth a year's wages. Here we go again. Not just greed and envy, but greed and envy disguised hypocritically as spirituality. Verse 6 continues, he did not say this because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief. As keeper of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. I wonder if at some point after the resurrection, maybe the disciples, it dawned on them, like, okay, Matthew, he was a tax collector, he had his booth, he was trained in finances, and he had all that background and experience, and he would have been the natural guy to carry the money bag. Why was Judas pushing so hard to be the keeper of the bag? Oh, wait a minute. Jesus knew all along. So why doesn't Jesus now take this opportunity to rebuke Judas for his dishonesty and his hypocrisy? There might be a good reason for that. Normally, I don't like to cross over too much into the parallel accounts. But in this case, it might be worth pointing out what happened next in Matthew 26 when we read this story. Matthew tells us that right after this, Judas went out and he initiated a deal with the Pharisees. Had Jesus called out Judas for his greed and for his habit of stealing from the money bag, Judas might have felt that he was now under too much scrutiny to carry through with his plans to go out and strike a deal with the Pharisees. And this all has to go down. This has to go down on time in 6 days. in accordance with the schedule of the Passover. So instead of condemning Judas for his greed and hypocrisy, he just focuses on Mary, both defending her and commending her. Verse 7 continues, "Leave her alone," Jesus replied. "It was intended that she should save this perfume for my burial." Again, in that parallel account in Matthew 26, it's recorded that Jesus adds these words. This has always just struck me. He says, "I tell you the truth, wherever this gospel is preached throughout the world, what she has done will also be told in memory of her." Jesus basically said, "I'm going to make this woman a hero." He deliberately put her story in billions of Bibles. And the story has been told countless millions of times from Christian pulpits, every continent on earth. The world needs to see this woman's example of extraordinary devotion and love for Jesus. I sometimes shake my head when I hear people say things like, "Oh, Christianity is a sexist religion. It elevates men and it degrades women." And when I hear that kind of thing, I think this is a person who really is talking, but they've not really studied what they're talking about. Take just this story, and we could produce many, many more, especially if you go to the Gospel of Mark. But just take this story. The Sanhedrin. All men, right? Who are they in this story? Scoundrels, villains, murderers, the disciples. And you're saying, well, just Judas, right? Well, the other accounts say that there were several disciples who were kind of outraged. We know what was in Judas's heart because it tells us. But Judas, a man, right? Hypocritical, greedy. The woman in the story, Mary, pure, incomparable devotion to Christ. Selfless love, sacrificial generosity, right? An inspiration to all of us, not just women, but to men now for about two full millennia. So get off her case, Judas. And if you're really that concerned for the poor, verse 8, "You will always have the poor among you, but you will not always have me." At this point, I imagine Judas was sufficiently embarrassed and probably angry, too, judging by what he did next. Now, just quickly, incidentally, Jesus' statement on the poor here, I think we need to be careful about what we do with that. I've heard people say, quote Jesus almost as if to dismiss our obligations to the poor. The poor you'll always have with you. The rest of the New Testament makes very clear that our obligation to the poor remains. The teachings of the apostles, their example, you think of Cornelius, it says that your gifts to the poor have gone up as a memorial offering to the Lord, right? And on we could go with evidence that tells us we have an obligation to the poor, though perhaps not those who choose to be poor as much. But don't make too much of what Jesus was saying. Jesus was saying, right now is not the time to think about the poor. I'm going to die. This woman is anointing me for death. This is a beautiful thing. A beautiful thing. So that scene is over. And while it has been unfolding, there's a migration taking place. Verse 9 says, "Meanwhile, a large crowd of Jews found out that Jesus was there and came not only because of him, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead. So the chief priests made plans to kill Lazarus as well, for on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and putting their faith in him." It's amazing the lengths to which people will go to justify their crimes, even the most heinous crimes, even murder. They will do it on religious grounds. Can't you just hear them?
Can't you just hear the Sanhedrin as they're talking together? Okay, we've got to kill Jesus. We've got to get rid of him. And not just Jesus. We've got to get rid of Lazarus too. Lazarus? Why Lazarus? Well, Lazarus, people are listening to his story. And he's telling them that Jesus raised him from the dead. And there are witnesses. My sisters were there. And now we've got some of our own people going over and joining him. And they're going to be deceived. And the whole nation is going to be deceived. It's for the spiritual good of our people that we have to kill Lazarus. Yes, yes. If we love God. Right? How many times has that been repeated over the millennia? Using false spirituality to justify evil. Look at what's said about Lazarus here. Wouldn't that be a great thing for people to say about you? Look at that. On account of him. On account of him. Think about that. Imagine somebody saying that about you. On account of Rick Walls, many people were going over to Jesus and putting their faith in him. On account of Nathan Stoner, on account of Angie Fisher, many people were going over to Jesus and putting their faith in him. Isn't that cool? What a great thing. What a great thing. So Lazarus gets his story in here too. Lazarus didn't sit on his miracle. I don't think this is simply saying that Lazarus was noticeable and so people saw him and they automatic. I think Lazarus was telling his story. I think it's stronger than that. I think he had a testimony. I think he was actively involved in making disciples for Christ. And so I would say to you, Christian brother or sister, what are you going to do with your miracle? Now, I'm only talking to believers right now. If you're an unbeliever, I'm really glad you're here because you need to learn about Jesus. And this is good stuff. And I hope you really want to know about him. But to Christians, believers, what about your miracle? You going to sit on that? Do you know that you going from death to life, just like Lazarus did, that's supernatural. That's a miracle. No less than Lazarus's physical, going from death to life. You going to sit on that miracle? Are you going to be like Lazarus? For on account of him, many of the Jews were going over to Jesus and putting their faith in him. Good for Lazarus. And I'll bet if somebody said, you know, Lazarus, they're thinking about killing you too. You better shut up. I wonder what he would do. I wonder if he would just maybe do what some of our brothers and sisters in China are doing in Venezuela and elsewhere. I have a feeling that Lazarus would say, no, I'm just going to keep telling the story. But you know, the real hero of this story is Mary. The real hero of all the stories, of course, is Jesus. But you know what I mean here. This contrast that we see in this story, I wonder if it's deliberate. I kind of think it is. This contrast between Mary and these other guys, right? You got Judas. Judas is coveting. Judas is angry. Judas is greedy. He's hypocritical, right? You've got the Sanhedrin. They're conniving. They're conspiring to kill. And Mary, simple love, just gives her best. What kind of love does Jesus want from you and from me? If Jesus made sure that this story is recorded for us as an example, what kind of love does Jesus want from you and me? Is it the kind of love that says, well, I wonder how much I can get away with and have everybody still think that I'm a believer and have Christians admire me? How much can I get away? How much can I preserve for myself and still appear to be devoted? How do I pull that off? What if I just poured out half of that bottle and saved back half for myself? Do you think that Mary, go back in time, just imagine this in your mind. Do you think that Mary, prior to all of this, as Martha's getting everything ready, and Mary goes and she finds this bottle of pure nard, probably buried in the ground somewhere because it's worth a year's wages, When she pulled it out, do you think she was wrestling and going, I wonder if I could probably fill the whole room with the smell if I just use half or a quarter. What could I get away with here? What's the least I can do and still, you know, do this deed for Jesus? Can you picture that? I can't picture that. I think Mary went and got her jar of nard, and if it would have been a gallon, she would have poured it all on Jesus. I believe that. $46,000. That's what the average income is in this county. A year's wages. Jesus worth that? What kind of love does Jesus want from you and me? The Mary kind of love and devotion, I think. I think that's why he preserved her memory for us. He wants us to see the example of someone who is caught up in total love and adoration for Jesus. It's not the perfume. You know that. It's the heart. The perfume flows from the heart, right? It's not the sacrifice. It's the motive. It's the motive that he's interested in. Why did God tell the Israelites that he hates their sacrifices? You know he does that. Still doing them. Still doing the sacrifices. I commanded it, and I hate them. Is it because he wanted bigger bulls? Bigger lambs, maybe? Why does he say that? In some cases, it was a pleasing aroma. In other cases, it was a stench in his nostrils. Why? Same sacrifice, same smell. What was different? It was the heart. You're a Christian. Good. I'm talking to Christians. Do you have the most important thing right? Do you have the most important thing right? You think about Revelation chapter 2, the Ephesians. You've done this well. You don't tolerate the false teaching. That's good. All that's good. But you've lost your first love. You've lost your first love. If this part isn't right, nothing's right. Do you know that? And we say, you know our position on, you know, we should all be growing. We're commanded to grow in our knowledge of the Lord. We're supposed to be serving each other. But you know what that's all built on? Is our love for Jesus. Do you have that right? Things might look right. Business might be going well. Kids might be getting good grades. They might be excelling in school. You might have lots of friends. And things might look good. But you know that nothing's right if this isn't right. And so I ask you, do you have that kind of love for Jesus, that kind of devotion, that total adoration that Mary shows for us? Don't let this example that Jesus preserved for us, don't let it go to waste on you. This is convicting to me. I'll be honest. I'm the guy looking at the nard and saying, a whole year. I've worked a whole year. How much can I get away with? I'm that guy. What, am I going to lie to you? I don't want to be that guy. Do you want to be that guy? You want to be that lady? This isn't a question for you people. This is a question for all of us, including me. All of us. Do we have the Mary kind of love? I'm not thinking about what that costs. I've got the Savior right in front of me. Oh, that we would. Oh, that we would love Jesus extravagantly. Oh, that we wouldn't care about the ounces and count the ounces. That everything would be His.